Well, what a delight to be with you all here. Such an encouragement already this morning. Thank you for coming, and Raymond, thanks for inviting me here. You know, several years ago, I was in college about 30 years ago. Our friends back in the 90s, we had some friends from college, my wife and I, who went on to become missionaries in Hungary, and they served in Hungary for several years, and when they came back, Then we had supported them and remained friends. They brought us this really amazing gift. And that gift was a poster, it was a print of an old poster, probably from the 19th century, and it was all in Hungarian, which is what made it cool. I've since seen this poster in English and lots of others as well, so it wasn't just a Hungarian thing. Maybe you've seen it too, but it was a poster that was very fascinating to look at because it had lots of little details going on, and the poster was oriented this way, up and down, and large part of the poster had all these little events going on, like people doing lots of bad things. So like in the 19th century, that included like rolling one of those big wheels or something with a stick. I guess that was bad to do, but other really bad things to do, like, you know, betting on dog fighting and going to brothels and doing all these bad things. And there's little vignettes of all these bad things happening. And at the top of the poster on that side, you can imagine there was this city that was on fire, lightning and demons and everybody, you know, being tortured. And it was this horrible scene. Now, the smaller part of the poster on the other side, there were all these people doing good things, so going to church and, you know, going to hospital and visiting people and doing all these good things. At the top of that side of the poster, there was a celestial city. It was all heaven and very clear. And you can imagine, maybe some of you can imagine, what Bible verse was printed at the very bottom of that poster. It was the text that I want us to look at today. Let me just read it for you. It says, Jesus says in Matthew 7, "Enter by the narrow gate, for easy and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and few are those who find it, but narrow and difficult is the way that leads to life, and few are those who find it." Those verses have long been interpreted, and you can understand in the way of this poster that you can imagine that I've got in Hungarian, I've seen of others, and I think it makes sense, right? I mean, we can all think of people, maybe you were on this path yourself, but maybe you have family members or friends. You can imagine they're living their lives full of all these bad things, and according to the Bible, the end of that is destruction, both destruction in our lives in this life as well as in the future. And we can think of the narrow way of doing Christian things, etc., as being good. Now, while I understand that as a natural way to interpret these verses, this morning I'm going to suggest to you that if we read those famous verses from Matthew 7, 13, and 14 carefully in their context, we'll see that's not actually, I think, what Jesus is talking about. Not at all. So what I want to do today is look at these familiar verses again in the context where they come, which is Jesus' Sermon on the Mount from Matthew 5 to 7, and see what they might be saying. Now, my wife, Tracy, is very skilled. She's a professional mosaic artist. She's very creative. She owns an art studio, does lots of art, and teaches classes, etc. And her main medium is Italian glass tile mosaic. So she makes these amazing things by taking glass and nipping and cutting and scoring and shaping all these tiny little pieces of glass that she puts into these amazing patterns. And she sees it all while she's doing it, but it's often hard for me to see. And in fact, you have to kind of get back from her. If you're too close looking at one of her mosaics, you really can't tell what's going on, but you have to get back from it. And I like to think of the Sermon on the Mount that way. It is a very elaborate piece of mosaic by a very skilled artist. And there are lots of different things going on in the Sermon on the Mount, lots of different shapes and colors and sizes, and we need to kind of get back from it a little bit to understand. I just read for you something from very near the end in Matthew chapter 7, 13, and 14, but to understand it, we need to get back from it. Or to change the illustration a little bit, do you remember those like eye bender pictures? I know when I was growing up, at least, Ranger Rick magazine or something, I don't know what you had, where there was like a really close picture, a really close-up picture, and you had to try to figure out what was it because you were too close to it. I'm afraid maybe that's what's happened with these familiar verses in Matthew 7, 13, and 14. So what I want to do before we go back to them and look at them, I want to pull back and say, what's the big picture? What's going on in the Sermon on the Mount that might help us see the big picture of it? So if you have a Bible, you can grab one in front of you, the chair. It'd be great if you would turn to the first book of the New Testament in Matthew chapter 5. In the Pew Bible, it looks like it's on page 809. And I'm not going to read it all. I just want you to have it in front of you because I'm going to run through this most famous portion of the whole Bible. This is it, Matthew 5 to 7, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And just ask, what's going on before we get to chapter 7? And I'll just give you one word that I think makes sense of all of it, that just to kind of hang your thoughts on here at the beginning. And that word is cardiographic. Cardiographic. So I just want you to think about that the Sermon on the Mount is focused on the heart. So I think you'll see what I mean shortly. But let's start. How does the Sermon on the Mount start? It starts with these very famous things called the Beatitudes, where in nine verses there, Jesus talks about what the blessed or happy or truly flourishing life looks like. It starts in chapter 5 and goes 3 through 12. And I would sum all these up. Again, we could spend weeks just on teaching through these, but we'll just sum it up with this way, that if you look at every one of those Beatitudes, what he's talking about there is what I would call a posture of heart. So he's talking about a way of being in the world that is something about your heart. It's cardiographic. Having a poverty of spirit, being the kind of person that mourns over sin, having a meekness and a humility, having a hungering and thirsting for righteousness, showing mercy to other people, having a heart that's merciful, that's pure in heart. That's probably the heart of them all. And being a peacemaker, even though that sounds maybe like an activity, it is, but it's coming from a heart that is forgiving of others. And then it kind of culminates in this most unexpected way, being actually persecuted, which in some ways is only able to be something we can handle if all these other things are true of us, that we're humble and meek and pure in heart and peacemakers, etc. So the very first thing we see in this very famous Sermon on the Mount is that Jesus is really talking to us again cardiographically. He's not just giving us a list of things to do, he's describing a certain kind of person that will experience true happiness and flourishing. And then if you go on, the kind of the center of the Sermon on the Mount, the thesis statement of it, will land is in chapters 5, 17 to 20. And look at verse 20 for a second if you have a Bible. The shocking word, Jesus says, "I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven." Unless you and I have a righteousness that's greater than the scribes and Pharisees, we'll not enter the kingdom of heaven. That is shocking. And it's easy to misunderstand what Jesus is saying. Again, we could be inclined to say, well, he's saying you just have to do all this stuff. You have to be really, really extra super holy, right? But I suggest to you that he's going to unpack exactly what this greater righteousness looks like in the verses that follow from 5:21 through 48 and really all through the rest of the sermon. And if you let your eyes glance over 5:21 to 48, I won't read them all. What's going on here? Well, you'll see again that the issue is always one of our hearts. So he says that you could have an external righteousness of not murdering somebody, but if your heart is full of anger and resentment and bitterness towards others, that's a problem. He says, yeah, you can have an external righteousness of not committing adultery. That's good. You shouldn't do that. But if you have a heart full of lust, then that's lacking this greater righteousness. So in every one of these examples, again, we see that there is a pattern here, that Jesus is pushing us to think very carefully about not just our exterior behavior, but our interior person. And then it goes on. If you glance ahead to chapter 6, you have another big section where he talks about what seem to be behaviors. They are behaviors. Praying, almsgiving, giving to help the poor, fasting, those are behaviors. But what's the real issue in chapter 6 as well? Are you beginning to see a pattern? Look at chapter 6, verse 1. Jesus says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who's in heaven." You see, it's the same issue. In all three examples he's going to give, he's pushing us to say, why are you doing these good things? It's good to give give to the poor. It's good to pray. It's good to fast. But what's the motive on the inside of what's going on? And whenever I teach this passage, I always sum it up. I like acronyms a lot. And so I always sum it up with the acronym of the POM, the praise of men. Now, I'd prefer to be more inclusive and say the praise of others, but the acronym for that's not as comfortable to say. So I just go with the praise of men. So it includes men and women here. So that is your motive on the inside the praise of others? So in the midst of these good behaviors, Jesus is again pushing to a cardiographic reading. Now, we could go on and show you the same thing throughout the rest of chapter 6, talking about anxiety, and anxiety is a function of loving the wrong things. We're loving the things of this world, and when we love the things of the world, then we're driven by anxiety about them. And it goes all throughout. That's not the only reason we have anxiety, but when we do try to love the things of the world, the result is not peace, but anxiety. And it goes all throughout, but are you seeing a pattern? The point is, all throughout the sermon, Jesus is pushing us to say, I'd sum it up this way, God sees and cares about our hearts. He sees the inside of us, and that's what he really cares about the most. He also cares about behavior. It matters what you do, partly because what you do actually shapes your heart. It goes both ways. What you do reflects your heart, and what you do shapes your heart. That's for sure. But the point of Jesus' teaching here is that God sees and cares about our hearts. Now, in light of all of that, when we get back down to Matthew 7, 13 and 14, which is part of the conclusion, let me read for you the verses again and see if they start to make a little bit more sense. Jesus says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. But the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and few are those who find it." Now, I think that Hungarian poster that I mentioned, and I think most of us tend to read these verses as thinking about that what Jesus is saying is the broad and easy way is the way of doing a bunch of bad stuff, the behavior, and the narrow way is doing a bunch of good stuff. And on the surface, it may seem like that. But look at those verses a little bit more closely. Let me just make a couple observations about them. First of all, I think a lot of times we tend to read these verses and concentrate on the numeric difference there, the few and the many. And it is true that there are more people not in church. There are more people in bed or at a cafe or doing whatever than there are here this morning. That is true. There are fewer who find the true way of life. It's certainly easier in the sense to not find the way of life than to find it. That's certainly true. And again, we tend to read these also as part of this sort of moral behavior that, again, the easy way, we think, like the Hungarian poster, we think, yeah, you know, it's hard to do the right thing. It's hard to stay faithful in a marriage that is disappointing. It's hard to love a difficult child, right, or a difficult parent, right? It's hard to do what's right on your taxes and to not take advantage of other people when you have some easy opportunity no one ever knows. It is harder to do righteous things like that. And it is way easier to do bad things. That's absolutely true. But I'd like to suggest to you that that's actually not the contrast that is here. The contrast is primarily on this issue of the ease of the one way and the difficulty of the other. But what is Jesus really talking about here? What is the easier way versus the more difficult way? And I'd suggest to you it's not about behavior. So what is it? In light of everything he's been saying in the sermon throughout, is he completely changing gears and saying, yeah, I've talked about caring about the heart all along, and now I'm just going to talk about behavior? No, I think what Jesus is saying in these verses is exactly what he has been saying all along, that the easy way that leads to destruction is when you and I live our lives focusing just on the outside, on behavior, or we might even call it religion, And the hard way, the difficult way, by contrast, is the same thing he's been teaching all along, focusing on who we are on the inside. Not being just content to be a good person outwardly, but recognizing and embracing the difficult way of the righteousness that surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, the way that focuses on the heart, not just on the behavior, whether it's good or bad. Think with me for a moment about the people with whom Jesus is talking. Like, who is he talking to when he gives the Sermon on the Mount? He's talking to conservative, first century Jewish people. And who are the main people he's pushing, especially the most conservative of the Jewish people, the scribes and the Pharisees? And who is Matthew talking to when he writes and records this and gives it to the church? He's writing to you and me, people who are committed to the Bible, people who are trying to do what's right and trying to live good lives. The audience of the Sermon on the Mount is the Pharisees and, as the Christian artist Andrew Peterson has described it, sometimes the church, which is unfortunately sometimes the second coming of the Pharisees. But he's talking to the Pharisees and the church. And the point is that Jesus is saying the narrow way to you Pharisees is not just doing all these externally good things, because they are good people. The Pharisees are very morally and doctrinally conservative people. They're not running around having affairs. They're not killing each other, right? They are actually living upright lives. And to them, he says, just like most of you here, you're living upright lives. And he's saying to us, the narrow way is the way not just of being content with outside lives, but the difficult way of honestly facing our hearts. Sure, Jesus is saying, you may be doing the relatively easy thing of not leaving your husband or wife and committing adultery with another person. But are you at every turn lusting for someone else? You see some other marriage, you think, oh, if I could just be with her, if I could just be with him, my life would be so much better. Or why is my marriage so difficult? I wish I would have been with that person. Maybe little flirtatious ways at work, or other ways that you kind of keep that little flame alive in your heart. The easy way is the one who just looks at the mere behavior and says, well, I'm not committing adultery, I haven't crossed that line. But the difficult issue, Jesus says, is, but what's going on in your heart? Or are you and I taking the broad and easy way of religion, in that sure, most of us here have not probably killed someone who's wronged us. Maybe someone has. But most of us have not killed anyone. But are your hearts overflowing with loathing and anger and hatred and mean speech? Maybe it's somebody else in the church that you felt like slighted you a little bit, and you just keep, every time you see them, you just, something gets triggered in your heart. Maybe it's somebody at work who's really wronged you, maybe misrepresented you, maligned you, gotten advantages over you. Jesus says, I'm glad you're not murdering people at your job. That's a good thing, right? He is, just to be very clear, Jesus is not pro-murder. But he's saying, that's not enough. That's the easy way. The narrow, difficult way is being willing to look on the inside at what's going on. You see, God sees and cares about our hearts. The difficult way is the way of utter nakedness before God, of utter and painful and difficult at times honesty, facing who we are honestly, allowing ourselves to be laid open before God, to allow the Word of God to point and dig so deeply that it even divides bone and marrow. This morning, my hotel room, I was on my knees, and just had this moment again of like all the ways in which I build, just aware of all the ways in which I build these sort of walls between myself and God. Either certain areas of my life that I don't want him to deal with, or just even just my general, so I've got, I build these like paper walls between him to kind of control my life. You know, later on in Matthew, Jesus meets a real life person that I think is an intentional application of what he's saying here in chapter 7. If you have a Bible, you can turn there, you can just listen. It's in chapter 19. You may have heard this story before. There's a very conservative, very pious young man, a Pharisee again, who comes to Jesus, I think in all sincerity, with a real question. In chapter 19, verse 16, it says, "Behold, a man came up to him and said, 'Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life?' And he said to him," Jesus said to him, "'Why do you ask me about what's good? There's only one who's good. If you want to enter life, keep the commandments.' And the man said to him, 'Which ones?' And Jesus said," he basically quotes part of the Ten Commandments here, "'You shall not murder, not commit adultery,'" the same ones he was just dealing with back in chapter 5, right? "'You shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and your mother, love your neighbor as yourself.'" Verse 20, "The young man said to him, 'All these things I've kept, what do I still lack?'" Now notice, I don't think we have any reason to think this man is being insincere. I think this is a godly, young, Jewish, he's a synagogue ruler, the other gospels tell us. He's a leader among people. He's really doing these things. He's not being proud in saying that. He really is walking uprightly. But he somehow knows he still lacks something. And Jesus identifies it. He said, "If you would be," your translation says perfect, maybe a little better there would be, "if you'd be whole or complete," or whole or complete is probably a little bit clearer there in English. If you would have this sort of righteousness that surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, Jesus says, "Go, sell what you possess, give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." The young man heard this, he went away sorrowful, and that last line is the shocker, the sad part, "for he had great possessions." Jesus isn't saying that every person needs to sell everything they have. Jesus is the perfect soul doctor. He analyzes exactly what this man's problem was, not externally. He's got the external behaviors down. But Jesus was able to identify that this man's problem was a heart problem, that he loved the things, the wrong things, or he loved things in the wrong order, or the wrong proportion. What he lacked was not external behavior. He was a good man, like you are as well. But what he lacked was a heart oriented toward God. The easy way that leads to destruction focuses on the external. So if I could sort of redraw that Hungarian poster, I think it really needs three columns or three parts, not two. On the one side would be, in fact, a large way of living immorally and unintentionally and just foolishly that will result in destruction. But on the other side of the poster, according to what Jesus is teaching, there'd be people doing good things, living well, but without a faith and heart accustomed to God. And at the top of that side would also be destruction. And the narrow way between those two is the way of, yes, doing what's right, living well, not perfectly, very imperfectly. We all sin and stumble, but with a heart that is oriented toward God and is humble before him. You know, when I think about this same truth in the Old Testament, Jesus is not saying anything new in the Bible here. I think of the first two kings of Israel, King Saul and King David. Now, if you were to make a list of their external deeds, and especially their sins, here's one of the kings. Under peer pressure, when everybody was pressuring him to make the sacrifice, and the priest had not yet come, and they'd conquered this other nation. They had all the animals. They knew they were supposed to make a sacrifice. Everybody was freaking out. The priest was supposed to be here. He's not here. And so they finally he says, okay, you guys do it. Make the sacrifice to God. Give thanks to him. That's the sin of one of them. What's the sin of the other one? God has blessed him. He's up on top of his palace. He sees somebody else's wife and says, she's beautiful. Send for her. Sleeps with her. She gets pregnant. To cover it up, he sends another letter and says, her husband, put him on the front lines and then pull back so he'll get killed. So from an external perspective, which of those people would you want as your pastor or your king? Now, be clear, King David, who's the one who commits this horrible sin of adultery and murder, there's no way that he pays the consequences of that as well. That haunts him the rest of his life and brings destruction in his life with his own sons and other things happen. So it's not without its consequences. Saul, King Saul, is the other one. But who is the king that God blesses and gives the name all the way down to the Messiah? Jesus is the son of David in that line. What's the difference between those two kings? Do you remember what the Bible says? What was true of David? He was a man after God's own heart. So in no way does the Bible say that either of their sins are okay, and David's sins are worse on the external, but the difference between David, King David and King Saul was the same thing Jesus is talking about here, that God sees and cares about our inner person, our heart. And the metaphor he uses right after these verses is that when your heart is of a certain type, then that does bear fruit. It does look like righteous behavior, but it's got to start with the heart. So, what are we supposed to do with this? What are you supposed to do with this teaching this afternoon, tonight? What does it really mean for real life? Well, the first thing I would quite simply say is to remind you that God sees and cares about your heart. That's what he really cares about. That's what he really sees. And therefore, that's what we need to look at too. Now, I could think of lots of examples of this. Let me just share one. Among the many various things I do in my life, teaching, et cetera, A few years back, I taught for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, a middle school Bible class, which I would say is the Protestant version of purgatory, basically. So if I believed in purgatory, that's what would happen to me, I think. I love children. I have way too many of them myself. And I love teaching. I love teaching the Bible. It was really not so bad. But there were just moments, especially with like 20 or 24 junior high boys and some girls in there too, just running around. So there were some great moments. But imagine this one this one thing that happened. One day I was teaching in Genesis and was laying out like different views that Christians have had throughout the millennia about the creation accounts. And there's not just one view. There are different views about whether it's an old earth or a young earth and how mythological it is, all these kind of things. So I was just laying these things out and just encouraging the students to be aware that good, faithful Christians have held to different views. You know, some views are better than others, certainly, but good Christian people have held to different views throughout the time. And they were so engaged, and I thought, this is amazing. Okay, this is great. Like, they're with me and et cetera. Well, imagine how I felt then when over the next few days, I began to hear from various means that all the mothers of these junior high boys were very upset about what I had said in class, and were all talking to each other. All these mothers that I know. I'd stand next to them on the soccer field, right? Soccer sidelines. With, you know, we all, our kids were growing up together, and they were talking about this and were very upset and were getting angry. And one in particular, this woman I knew, I thought liked me, was like stirring up all these other women and upset with me about things I had supposedly said from the, of course, always reliable junior high boy witness. You know, I mean, I'm sure they completely, with complete nuance, explained exactly what I said, right? No, of course they didn't. So imagine how I felt, right? I began to hear all this. I'm thinking, I know these people, and none of them said anything to me about it. I only heard it secondhand. Like, nobody called me and said, hey, could we just get some clarification about what? Nothing. So I was hurt, I was angry, and I sat down to write an email, right? I'm Jonathan Pennington, Dr. Pennington, right? And you're ripping on me, right? And then, so I wrote one email that was just going, you know, full of Bible verses, and I was going to, you know, rebuke them for not coming to me directly. It was this brilliant crafted piece, you know, and, you know, in the cinema that stars Jonathan Pennington, I was the hero in this whole thing, right? My wife came by, looked over my shoulder and said, I don't think you want to send that, probably. And thankfully I didn't, right? So then I was thinking, okay, I'm going to take I'll take the high road or the humble road, and realize that how I respond to them matters, right? And so I'm going to do the noble thing, and I'm going to not be accusatory. I'll just, you know, I'll do the right thing. So I wrote them a very humble note and said, hey, just, I've heard that some of you are upset. Just wanted to clarify, sorry for any ways I was confused, you know, when it, other ways that things that I said that might have been confusing to your kids. I care, I'm happy to talk about it. So I did the right thing, took the noble way, and was, I think I did the right thing. That was a good behavioral choice. I mean, I've been a Christian long enough, I've been a human in society long enough to know that it's better for me if I respond that way than if I respond angrily, right? That's good. But then I just noticed over the next several days and week and weeks that I was still so mad, and that I was still so hurt, and that even though I had done the right thing externally, and I'm glad I did that, it was better to do that than to write an angry email, God wanted to do something deeper than just me doing the right thing. That I needed to look in my heart and say, okay, why is it so important to me that everyone thinks well of me? Like, what's going on in my heart that when someone misrepresents me, that my response to that is not owning that and saying, hey, maybe I wasn't clear, but instead anger, right? And self-justification and a desire to tear other people down to justify myself. What's going on inside of me that's the place where God wanted to do the next level of work? It was relatively easy for me to do the right thing on the outside, and I'm glad I did. But that wasn't the narrow way of Jesus to begin to look on the inside. That's what really matters, and that's what matters for you as well. And I'll just ask you, what about you? What situations did you face this past week where maybe you blew it behaviorally? Maybe you did just blow up on somebody or do something wrong or fell into some besetting sin, and you see that your heart is wicked? Or maybe the opposite. You supposedly did the right thing, and you did. You did the exterior right thing, but again, you realize that relative to your heart, it's kind of like going to a furniture store or something where they've got these huge TVs, and then you go up to them and you realize, oh, there's like nothing on the inside. Like, you pick it up, it's just like a plastic TV. There's no innards to it or something. Is that where you are today? Then maybe you've been coming to church for a while. Maybe you grew up in a Christian home, or just maybe even just a home with good parents who taught you to do the right thing and say yes, sir, or, you know, get good grades, whatever it is. But when you look in your heart, you realize, you know, that there's a disconnect here. What do you do? What do you do when you look inside in these situations? And in fact, probably both things are true. There are probably moments when your heart does have right inclinations, and then lots of moments when it doesn't, right? What do? You cry out to God. And you say, Lord, have mercy. I believe, help my unbelief. You do the only thing you can do, the only thing I can do. You start being honest and confess that there is a distinction, that there is an inconsistency, there's a brokenness between even all of our good behavior and our innermost person. Your need and my need is not for us to try to kind of just force good fruit out of our lives constantly, but to start to look inside, because friends, that is so tiring. If you're just going through the motions because you know pragmatically, or you're too embarrassed to not do the right thing, or maybe you're afraid of the wrath of your parents, maybe they're not even living anymore and you still are seeking their affirmation. If whatever other reasons you might be motivated that's not from a heart that is oriented toward God, that is so tiring. It is so tiring. And you won't be able to sustain it. The only solution is to come to the altar of honesty. And here's the good news. God already knows that about you. He knows your heart better than you do. You can't even figure out most of your motives for what you do. He knows them completely, and He loves you. Did you hear that? He knows all your worst, mixed, messed up lives, the secret sins and the heart, and He says, I love you. I am a Father who created you and am very happy to redeem you. I'm not reluctant. I'm not angry. I'm not arms crossed. I'm not whatever father or mother you had, you blew it again. Well, you'll learn this time. He is open-armed, and He says, I see you, and I love you. Come, no longer try to be this exterior person, trying to keep it all together when your heart is broken, in need and desperate and full of wickedness. Don't try to do it anymore. Come to me and let me begin by the power of the Spirit to transform you from the inside out. He knows you and He loves you. Do you believe that? And there is life. Because when Jesus says, enter by the narrow gate, that's not a threat. These verses are not a threat. This is not Jesus being angry. He's inviting you and me to life. He's saying, don't go the way of destruction, either the way of just living immorally or the way of trying to keep it all together by looking good on the outside. Neither of those are going to find life. You will only find life by beginning to take Jesus' yoke upon you, which is the yoke that just says, God, I am broken and I have nothing to offer apart from your Spirit transforming me and working in me. And when you do that, friends, you will find life. You will find life. You will not find condemnation. You will not find rejection. When you begin to open your heart to God in honesty, to enter the narrow gate, you will find life. Let me pray. Thank you, our Heavenly Father, that you are above and beyond what we could ask or imagine. That Jesus, your ways are so beautiful, you are so kind, and we come to you today. And I'm sure there are some people here who just don't even know what to think. And there are some who know their brokenness. For all of us, I pray that you'd fill us with your Spirit so that we could taste and see your goodness and perceive you as you reveal yourself in Holy Scripture, as kind, as a father, as loving, as offering life. Come, God, and do what we can't do for ourselves. Quicken in us the ability to open our mouths to you and receive your food of life. I pray these things in Jesus' powerful name. Amen.